Well, welcome to the More to the Story podcast. I'm so glad you've come along. This is going to be a fun episode for those of you who like history. And if you don't like history, you should like history. I want to make sure to get people's interest in my favorite subject, the 19th century Methodist movement as a whole. And why is this important? Why is this important for our time? Well, you're going to find out, because many of the things that are happening across the globe right now as Methodism is again kind of expressing itself in new ways. And when I use the word Methodism, I'm thinking of it in a very broad way that includes denominations like the Salvation Army, the Free Methodist Church, the Church of Nazarene, and the like. And so in that broad movement, there have been historical antecedents that have really kind of could give us insight into our own times. And so that's what I'm hoping you'll get from today's podcast. This podcast comes to you from Wesley Biblical Seminary, where we are developing trusted leaders for faithful churches. Our spring semester is getting underway here very soon. And so if you're interested in going deeper in your faith and preparing to be a pastor who's ready to serve trusted churches around the world, we would love to be connected with you. We might have people listening today from Australia, and we have a polysynchronous learning modality, which makes it possible for us to have people all around the globe participating in our programs. We have more students from more than 60 different countries, so it's really a fascinating thing. All right. Also, I have my friend Bill Roberts, who is a financial planner who helps sponsor this podcast. Those of you, he often helps Salvation Army officers and pastors and people who need to think about the way they're going to retire. And often we don't do that until too late. So check out WilliamHRoberts.com. And I would love for people to sign up for my email list at AndyMillerIII.com. And if you do, you'll get a free resource called 5 Steps to Deeper Teaching and Preaching. There's several other things there, small group studies, one on heaven, one on the book of Jude. These are video-based studies that you could use in a Sunday school class or in a small group. We'd love for you to check those out at AndyMillerIII.com. That's AndyMillerIII.com. All right, I am welcoming into the podcast now my guest, Major Peter Collins, who comes to us from down under. Peter, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much, Andy. I'm on holidays at the moment and on the New South Wales coast. The Pacific Ocean is just 5 kilometers away, and I'm presenting this from my sister-in-law's lounge room. So
okay. Well, thank your sister-in-law for us. We're so glad that technology gives us this opportunity to connect together. And the reason I've invited Peter on the podcast is he sent me his book. And one way to get on my podcast is to send me a book for free. And then I probably is a definite way in. And it must have been significant, because this is, if those of you are watching on YouTube, it's a pretty thick book. It's a hardcover book. And it coming from all the way down on the coast there in Australia. It's a significant send. So thank you, Peter, for sharing this with me.
That's okay. Yeah. It's a self-published book. Marg and I decided to underwrite it. And it all started because of COVID.
Yeah.
After 1 week of COVID, I had enough. So I went back to my earlier interest in Salvation Army history and looking at the life and the interaction of William Cook with William Booth. And 3 years later, I had enough material to publish a book, and I rang up a friendly printer and said, look, I just want you to bind this, all these pages, these 500 pages, I want you to bind them.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, no, we'll do better than that. We'll do 6 copies as a tryout. And then after that, we'll see what happens. Yeah.
Fine. Well, the book is called Two Williams and Their Contemporaries. And it's William Cook, who lived 1806 to 1884, and William Booth. Now, there's much more than just that, but this is a subject that is very fresh to me. I've written about William Cook in my dissertation, which isn't published yet, and I might have to change him based upon your work. We'll see.
But nevertheless,
it's really interesting to me. But before we get into that, Peter, would you just tell us? I introduced you as Major, so you're a retired Salvation Army officer now, but tell us just a little bit about yourself and then before we get into this book.
Okay. I'm married to Margaret.
Yeah.
I've got three grown-up daughters, 8 grandkids. We have been retired for 8 years, And we worship at the Arndale Corps in Adelaide. Margaret's the Corps Treasurer, and I look after the men's ministries. And we're both involved in the Just Brass program, which is a mentoring music program for children in state primary schools. And we've got about 45 children from 10 schools in the area. And we see them twice a week, once at school for a lesson, and then they all come together for a combined rehearsal on Thursday afternoon. And we just love the kids and the interaction that they have with the Corps. And we ask the Lord to bless the ministry. And it's a long-term ministry. Yeah. We associate with the kids for up to 4 years and get to know the families very well. And we feel so blessed to be part of it.
Yeah. Yeah, so tell us a bit about some of the appointments you had. I know you had at least one appointment at a training school where you got...
That's right, yeah.
But tell us about some of the things you did in
your... Well, we started our officership at the old training college in 68 Victoria Parade with the castellated towers and red brick designed by Herbert Booth.
Wow.
But we finished it at the next college. So the training colleges have bookended our service. We spent 5 or 7 years at the first college, and then we were corps officers, then in youth work, divisional secretary, back to corps work, then back to the training college, and then we retired. In fact, my last job was to be the decommissioner for the second college.
Oh, bless you. Okay. So that would be Australia South. I guess now it's one Australia.
Yeah. At the time, it was Australia South College. The training college is now situated in Melbourne, called Eva Burrows College, an offshoot in Sydney as well.
Yeah. Interesting. So, that's interesting, the various places you're able to serve. Now, one of the interesting things to me is that as you look at this research that you put together and you traveled the world making this happen and looked at a variety of things, here's my little take. William Cooke, COOKE, sometimes some people say Coke, I say Cook, is often underrated character in the life of William Booth because... often William Booth's, and I'm going to give my little intro and then you correct me if you want. So William Booth's early biographers, particularly Harold Begbie and even W.T. Stead and St. John Ervine, characterize Booth as an anti-theological zealot. And he was so much so, like Harold Begbie would say things like he was plagued by theology. So anything that moved in the direction of formalized religion or traditional theology or theological disciplines was seen as something that William Booth just couldn't stand. And that was personified by his time in the Methodist New Connection and his training in the Methodist New Connection. And people think about his leaving in 1861, the supposed dramatic moment of that time. And he only spent a couple of months in William Cooke's training program. And obviously, he just couldn't stand it. And he just didn't want to read anything. He just wanted to go out and save people. And therefore, he was better off. Well, because of that positioning, it's made it seem like William Cooke has not been a very helpful person in William Booth's life. And people like Alex Nichol, who was one of the early biographers and early, leader of William Booth, who eventually left, even like said, oh, he just took his theology book and threw it against the wall. He just couldn't stand it. And that conflates an earlier story, which was actually about something else in his life. All of this to say, William Cooke doesn't get very much credit in William Booth's story. And you've done a great work in helping us unearth the significance of William Cooke as an individual, but also his influence on William Booth. So now, do you want to disagree with me about anything I said there before we get going?
No, I want to say that what you're saying is exactly right. William Cooke in 1883, the year before he died, wrote a letter in support of William Booth, when Mr. Charlesworth was giving Booth some trouble on behalf of what was happening with his daughter in Europe. But William Cook wrote the following. He's to affirm Booth's character. He said that he is an outstanding English student. He has comprehensive general knowledge. He's a diligent student, and I attest to his character. And I thought that was nice to read.
Yeah. You know?
And of course, that letter is in the book that you've got on your table before you. It's interesting going back to when Booth came to London when he was 20.
Yes.
He eventually linked up, after leaving the Wesleyans, he linked up with the reformers. And he felt then at the time that with the people both at Binfield House and also at Spalding, sorry.
Yes.
That
these
he
were
didn't
congregations have the, he served.
Yeah,
he, congregations in these locations. With
that's
the
right.
Methodist reformers.
He had insufficient material and he wasn't well equipped. And one of the things he said was, I've got to make sure that I don't start courting a young lady too soon, because if I do, I'm sure that's going to affect the possibility that I have to improve myself. And the next thing we know, that Rabbits, E.H. Rabbits, arranges for him to take Catherine home in a cab. And within 20 minutes, Booth is absolutely hopelessly in love with Catherine Booth. And so that affected his early plans. Mind you, she helped him. She provided him with material. He knew he needed help. And she was the biblical scholar. She was the theologian. And she was able to help him in those days. In 52, there was a thought that he might link up with the Congregational Training College. But after reading the material in his own heart and with his knowledge of Wesleyan theology and the life of John Wesley, he stopped doing that and put the book to one side, if you like. The book that we're talking about is by eminent theologians from the Calvinist school, right, and not Booth's book, which is something that Nicole got wrong.
Right, yeah. Right.
Now, I think probably that gives you an idea of some of the early life of Booth, but I should add that when he went, after vacillating five times, when he actually ended up in the household of William Cook and was there for four months, within a month, there was a revival experiences happening in the London circuit of the Methodist New Connection. And William Cook said to William Booth, "William, I've just listened to your sermon. My daughter's made a decision along with 23 others. Thanks very much. It's wonderful. Keep going the way you're going.
Right.
And God will bless you."
Yes, he said these things, yeah.
And William had taken courage and he decided, well, I'm not going to muck around here. I'm actually going to say it as it is and how I feel it. And so he gave a demonstrative sermon. And, I mean, he knew Wesleyan theology. He had rejected Calvinist theology. So you can't say that he was not versed in a reasonable grasp of theology. And then before you know it, there was a revival in the London circuit. Then he was asked to go to Guernsey, which was under the London circuit as well. And there was a revival there. And then he went to the stronghold of the Methodist New Connection in the Potteries at Longton, one of the six towns in the Potteries. And there were 1,200 people committed. Now, where would he have the chance to settle down and do a 3 or 4 year course in theology? For the rest of his life, he was a revivalist.
Yes.
And with more experience, he ended up with stronger convictions. And in the end, the Oxford University, bless him, awarded him with a doctorate of civil law for his services to humanity and to the spread of the gospel.
Yes.
So you can't say that he wasn't equipped to be an evangelist.
Right. Or a pastor or an administrator or any of those type of things. It's easy. Yeah. There has been a tendency to take leaders who particularly have a pragmatic bent, like William Booth, who wanted to resist language that would be connected to what he saw as dead religion. Now, that's not exactly accurate, because he picked up a very live religion from the Methodist world that he was a part of. Nevertheless, because of that, people are quick to make him seem like only a pragmatist, as if there was no theological foundation. Now, he wasn't an academic. He wasn't trying to be a scholar, but he was somebody who was he was well-read. And as you indicated, this course of study that he went through with William Cook was formative. Here's one interesting thing. I do want to get back to the 1850s here. What became the Salvation Army was East London Christian Revival Association, started in 1865.
Yeah.
But one thing, just thinking about Cook's influence, you might have seen this as well. When I was at the archives in London, the International Heritage Center of the Salvation Army, I found in their special collections some of Branwell Booth's books, and they have William Cook's Christian Theology in its sixth edition. And it was very interesting to me as I opened that text up. I was holding Branwell Booth is a son of William Booth, who took over
from
his leadership. Yeah. I'm just saying this for our audience. I know you know all this.
Yeah.
But when I opened it up, I found this volume was annotated significantly.
Yeah.
Written in the margins. And actually, I found a few flowers that Branwell Booth had put in those pages. That was kind of fun, yeah, too. But what I saw was, I could see Branwell, and I asked the Stephen and Ruth to compare the signatures, and they said that this was Branwell's writing. Branwell Booth is very engaged with that 700-page theological text, and it just shows the significance that Cook had for the Booth family.
Yeah, so I've seen the pages, and I didn't see them directly, but they were sent to me, and I couldn't read at all.
Right,
but you're right. There was that interest. After all, the first edition, the 46th edition, was the one that William Booth would have been looking at.
Right,
in number 3, the Crescent, Albany Road in Camberwell, and So
he would have. This would have been the theological text, most likely, that William Booth studied, in addition to Richard Watson's systematics as well.
Yeah.
So, if we want to know where, and there are some very interesting studies that have been done comparing William Booth's hermeneutical perspective with William Cook's, who had a high value for the influence of the Spirit.
That's right.
So I think that's anything else, like some of the theological influences you see in Cook that maybe were picked up by Booth and the Salvation Army?
Well, certainly Cook was strongly opposed to that section of the church that placed an overemphasis on ritual. And so in that sense, Cook's ecclesiology was a low ecclesiology, and so that suited, if you like, the outlook of Booth, who was a revivalist. And you'd find it hard, I think, to fit in a ritual in a meeting led by a revivalist like William Booth. So he would have received an encouragement. Mind you, Cook did say in that letter I mentioned before that he didn't necessarily agree with everything that William Booth did. But he said, in essence, he is a good man, and he's changed because of his ministry. He's changed the lives of thousands and thousands of people for God.
One of the reasons that there's some tension around Cook within Salvation Army historiographic literature is related to some things that happened in 1861. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, every year that Booth was involved in Methodist New Connection, there was a question about would he or would he not be an evangelist? Mm-hmm. And in his heart, William Booth wanted to be a continuing evangelist away from a pastorate. Now, for 3 years that happened, but then in that third year, William Booth, I've got to be careful which William I talk about here, but William Booth experienced additional hardship. There was over-enthusiasm. There was bad press. There was health. There was traveling. There was a pregnancy of his wife. And although in his heart he wanted to keep going as an evangelist, what it turned out when he was sent to Brighouse, it was the best thing for him. Not only was it better for the family, I think that Catherine became pregnant again. And in that year, there was a 10% increase in the outcome of the ministry.
Wow.
And yet William Booth did not send in one field report to William Cook in that year. And having done that year, bearing in mind the year before, he had an amazing revival at Sheffield North in the Scotland Church, Scotland Street Church. Just amazing. And, you know, more than 1,000 converts, and the people there were so blessed and so grateful that 3 months later they presented him with a testimonial and gave him a picture, which is on the front of the book, by the way.
Oh, interesting.
To a booth, yeah. That dates back to 59, I think, 1859, yeah. And Catherine said to him, look, all this adulation is nice, but be careful, you know. Don't let it go to your head, she said. But they were so grateful. I'm just trying to work out why I'm taking down this track. What was the question again?
Oh, yeah. Well, so, you know, some people look at, so William Booth had an effective ministry indicating in the Methodist New Connection. And just for clarity, there were a lot of different Methodist ecclesial groups in the first 60 years after John Wesley's death. Methodist New Connection was the first one. And maybe for some reasons that I could share on another podcast, he joined a Methodist New Connection and then was eventually ordained in the Methodist New Connection, which is very important to him. But nevertheless, he left. He left. Yeah. And and that's where Cook comes into the story.
That's right. So the move to go from being a full-time evangelist to Brighouse was partially, I reckon, because the influence of Cook, who knew Booth so well and realised that he needed a break for his own sake and for his family's sake. Because there are times after a revival, he'd have to have a rest for 3 weeks. Such was his temperament. And when he was involved in a revival, it consumed him. But there were wonderful results. Now, the time came for him to move from Brighouse to Gateshead. And in Gateshead, there was a wonderful ministry, and it was the converting shop, and thousands were saved. And I think instead of being 150 people there, I think within 2 weeks there were 2,000 people in the congregation. And it was just a wonderful outreach. And the first year happened, the second year, in the third year, he'd experienced a serious ill health and he was away for 9 weeks. And in that time, Catherine Booth came in and took control of the church.
Yeah.
And the people loved her. And because of that, from then on, really, Catherine and William were able to work as a team, which brought wonderful results. But after 3 years there at Gateshead, someone had to make the decision, what are we going to do with William Booth?
Yeah.
And he wanted to stay He wants, excuse me, he wanted to become an evangelist. And I think there was a lot of division at the conference. After all, William Booth had done such a wonderful job as a pastor.
Yes.
And the committee that looked after appointments were really wanting to put him in at Newcastle, where there was difficulties with the elders in the church and it was suppressed, and someone like Booth could really lift it up. Anyway, in the end, the decision was made that he go to Newcastle, which eventually, didn't eventuate. But the trigger for that was when, in the midst of the debate, and the debate was bogged down, William Cook stood up and made a proposal that any person with gifts in revivalism, with the permission of the circuit leaders, could be involved in revival.
Yeah.
But at the same time, take on a pastorate.
Yeah.
Which meant that if William Booth was going to accept this, he would need to not only minister a difficult church at Newcastle, but also give himself to revivalism. And Catherine, for one, knew that it would kill him, more or less. And she often wondered how long he had to go, you know, she had to look after him.
Yeah.
So it was a disappointment for the Methodist New Connection. It was a disappointment for the Booths, but it began a four-year frontier ministry on their own, for them to do their own thing. And they didn't want to set up another church. They were quite happy to work with other churches. And after 4 years of amazing ministry, Booth, who'd wanted to be a traveling evangelist, if you like, stopped in London and stayed there. And of all people, found that his ministry was with the degraded, poor, the people in East London with all its filth and squalor.
Yeah.
That's where he found himself. And that's how the Christian mission started.
Oh, good. You did a great job summarizing that period. That's so good. One of the interesting things that happens in this period is that little story you told about Cook standing up.
Yeah.
Part of what is going on there is, and some army biographers have looked back at that as if he was stopping Booth, stopping him from being the evangelist he needed. But one interesting thing to think about is why that was significant. I don't know. This is the Methodist New Connection came about in part, and you detail this well, and I really like this. So if people are wanting to understand what was going on in these denominations, you do a great job of giving us that history, giving us Cook's history. We've just talked about almost the end of Cook's life right now. But this was a significant thinker, leader within Methodist New Connection. But one of the things that marked New Connection Methodism was that it was based in this principle of liberty and not being a top-down organization. They resisted Wesleyan Methodism and what they saw as an autocratic, pastor-led organization. And so the New Connection was one that was bringing the voice of the lay people together. So if you can imagine that there's this kind of almost Presbyterian model where there's the administration and the pastors and the lay people, well, in that setting, they were not at all interested in there being an evangelist who would be paid by the conference or the denomination and then somehow seen as above the churches. There's a high priority in Methodist New Connection, in the Methodist New Connection, for a local church. And a traveling evangelist almost works against that idea.
That's
and
right.
So do you feel, I feel like that was, and when I've read the documents, and I took a long time to, you know, transcribe the actual conference minutes.
That's right.
Maybe you saw those too at the John Rylands Library.
Right,
you
know? Yeah.
I mean, it takes a while, but I think there's something about that. What do you think about why? I mean, it's one thing to say, okay, well, William Booth just needed to get out and start his own thing. But why did the New Connection resist his desire to be an evangelist? Do you think my idea is right?
Yep. William Booth was so successful as a revivalist that the reports coming into the Methodist New Connection magazine, edited by Cook, were such that really it swamped everything else that was going. And that was a danger. William Cook not only had to encourage and foster William Booth, but he also had to encourage the rest of the circus as well. It's interesting that when Booth started up the Christian mission with Catherine, that they took on the doctrine, the governance,
yes,
the compassion of the Methodist New Connection, until the people in the mission themselves said, look, this is getting bogged down. There's too much discussion. You are a brilliant leader. You've got vision. We want you to lead us. Please lead us. And that's when it moved from conference-led polity to one in which William Booth was a benevolent but autocratic leader.
Yes.
And that system worked well for the introductory phase of the Salvation Army. But as you know, by the 1920s, there was need for change because of Bramwell, who faithfully kept up the model.
Yes.
But there was a lot of resistance because of nepotism and the fact that he was about my age, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it gets to be problematic at any that system. That's what I think William Booth, where he even said of his mentor, his hero, John Wesley,
yeah,
he even said that John Wesley was a failure organizationally. When I say that in my Methodist context, where I'm generally working with people who have been United Methodists, now Global Methodists, they're surprised but William Booth really felt like the weakness, it's not exactly correct, was that John Wesley wasn't organized. He didn't have enough control. He said such to Hugh Price Hughes.
Look, John Wesley was able to build up the Methodist societies, and they became the church in the end because he took control and made sure that his name was on the titles and that he had control of the ministry. And that was okay for the formative days of what became the Methodist Church.
Yeah.
But when in 1791, when Wesley passed away, it was only a couple of years before there was an eruption and the Methodist New Connection and Andrew Killam was created. Yeah. And it was all about polity. It was all about governance. Yes,
absolutely.
And the fact that it seems that the Wesleyan leaders were playing musical chairs, you know, with each other for all the top jobs, and it was London based, and there was a cry out from the provinces, you know, we need to change the mode, and there was a lot of upheaval in Methodism in that century to come.
Yeah, so one biographer, or one historian, calls it the age of disunity, and
yeah.
So and this is what I think part of the real innovation of William Booth and the army, the Salvation Army, is its polity. That was now there was antecedents to that in the Catholic tradition with the Jesuits, who also had a general. But at the same time, this within Protestantism is very unique to have an organization that's run like it's more than a military, because you have William Booth had ultimate ownership, power over who could be his successor, and could control all the finances, all of the personnel. This was a unique polity, unique system.
Not only that, but he had more or less the respect of his children. who had an incredible influence for a period, at a time when the Salvation Army was responding to immigration and going around the world. And by the time Booth died, I think the army was in 14 different countries, my memory tells me.
Yeah, it's a fast, and I think all of this happens because of a Wesleyan theology, understanding of conversionism, and this was fed to him by William Cook.
The interesting thing is that William Booth reverted back to John Wesley's pattern of strong leadership and personality leadership, if you like, and that's something that William Booth had. There's no doubt about it. He was a strong personality.
Absolutely. Go ahead. Oh, I was going.
W.T. Stead wrote that William Booth was a bit like Abraham Lincoln. You know, they were tall, spare men with a touch of humour, who were given a responsibility to fill the breach, you know, and for Abraham Lincoln, it was emancipation, it was the end of slavery. For William Booth, it was his great love for people. And because he loved them, he proclaimed the gospel to bring salvation to their souls.
Amen. Yeah. Well, and don't mention to Abraham Lincoln about the last name of the person who killed him.
Now, look, that never occurred to me.
John Wilkes.
You are astute.
Geographically, it's easy to pick up on that. American Salvationist. One thing you mentioned, and maybe we can close with this, is I've read, one of the joys has been to find many newspaper articles that have a stenographer who has written out the speeches of William Booth. And they also record the audience's reaction. And one of the things that I think is fascinating about stenographed all that literature, I would love to do more on this in the future, was William Booth was hilarious.
Yeah.
He was incredibly funny. People, I found some places where it'd say laughter after he'd say a comment, extended laughter. Maybe you've seen these too, where it'll say laughter for 30 seconds.
Yeah, they're in the book that you talk about, which is, it's you can get it for $29 from SPNS. Yes. That's American dollars.
Yeah. Where can they get it? SPNS, Salvation Army Publishing Supplies.
Yeah.
They can just Google it. Tell in us London, more about how they can find this book.
Yeah, okay. just email SPNS. We'll ring them up, and there's some copies there. You have to remember, it's a big book. It's a book full of information, and postage-wise is a bit of a challenge, but we didn't want to make it any smaller. We were the publishers, so wasn't the publisher coming on and saying, hey, cut it in half. No, this is what we're doing, and, you know, we just hope that it does some good around the army world and lifts the profile of William Cook and helps people to understand the romance of the Booths, his drive, his weaknesses, his challenges, and his victory. And in the end, the way in which he wanted to save the world. Yeah. So a remarkable story.
Well, thank you, Peter, for taking time to do this. Thank you for taking time with me, for sending me a book. It's something that I'm using. You have some original resources here that I've never seen. And
that's right. Yeah.
I really appreciate you taking the time to do this in your retirement. A great use of your retirement time, I need to add.
Okay. Now,
coming on the podcast today.
If it's okay with you, I'll go and have a swim now. All right.
Okay. Sounds good. Bless you.